This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
All right, so we've often talked about Meta Platforms, the company formerly known as Facebook, getting beaten up by investors, down about 50% this year alone, down from its all-time high back in September of 2021. Well, as Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin writes, despite Mark Zuckerberg's attempt to present Meta as an underdog, Max says it's not time to feel sorry for the social media giant. So let's get to it. This story on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And Max joining us on the phone from Queens. So Max, why shouldn't we feel sorry for Meta?
So what's happened over this year, basically, is the economy and kind of the social media ecosystem is sort of reverting to pre-COVID norms. So there was this moment, you know, in late 2020 and 2021, people were spending all of their time, on the internet, spending huge sums of money on, you know, online shopping. And that was amazing for Facebook's business and, Meta's business. And what's happened is we've seen a reversion, which has led to, you know, all these kind of like doom and gloom predictions, both from inside the company and from analysts. The thing is, the pre-COVID version of Facebook was still dominant. And when you look at the competitive landscape, yes, TikTok is gaining ground in terms of cultural mind share. They do have a lot of young people on the platform, but it's not even close. Facebook still basically owns social media, and that isn't changing anytime soon. And I think what's happening more is Zuckerberg is attempting to position the company both because it's in this antitrust conversation and as a way to, of course, get more productivity out of his employees to sort of try to find ways to continue to stay ahead of TikTok.
You know, Max, the other big story, obviously, with Facebook is this pivot to the metaverse. Why we're calling it Meta now instead of Facebook, and why I can never remember the ticker symbol for the stock. But I wonder, you know, it just seems like there's been nothing but criticism about that strategy. Surely part of that big investment in the metaverse is reflected in this just awful stock price performance this year. But I'm wondering how you're thinking about that, though. Is it possible that is an underdog story? I mean, is Zuckerberg seeing something in the metaverse that everyone else isn't? Or is this just a quixotic campaign that he's going to regret, do you think?
Well, I think Meta, Facebook, already controls a lot of the metaverse. You know, they acquired this as part of their sort of push into VR, into new platforms, right? They paid around $2 billion for this company called Oculus. That turned into Facebook, Meta's, you know, VR, AR thing. And the question is, how big does this market get, right? Zuckerberg is spending billions of dollars and rebranding the company and so on with the hopes that this is the next big platform, as big as mobile phones or something like that. But we don't actually know that that'll be the case. So in sort of the best case scenario, this becomes huge. It's the biggest PCs. And that's the vision that Zuckerberg has talked about for years, really. You know, the worst case is Facebook just controls a relatively small market and then continues to dominate social media as it does today.
I mean, it's still a $451 billion market cap company. I mean, it's
not too shabby.
It's exactly. And I think about, there's so many companies when we talk about the law of large numbers. I mean, you're looking at revenue still for this year forecasted to be something like $118 billion. I mean, this company still makes a lot of money.
Well, and one thing that I think people have sort of missed is there's been this conversation like, oh, maybe Meta, Facebook, has lost its cool, right? The young people are going to TikTok. And what it's easy to forget that has been going on for basically a decade. You know, it was about a decade ago that Facebook first lost its cool, maybe a little bit earlier than that. And Zuckerberg has found ways time and again to adjust, you know, and originally that adjustment meant buying Instagram and then copying aspects of Snapchat, buying WhatsApp, and we're seeing that play out again. He can't buy TikTok because of antitrust scrutiny, but he can copy it, and the company is making progress there. It hasn't yet found ways to generate revenue, but these TikTok-like products are definitely gaining in terms of users, time spent, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Max, I'm wondering, a lot of times when you see a company sort of stumble like this, at least its share price and sort of not posting that blockbuster growth like Meta once did, I would start wondering about the guy at the top and his, how secure his position is there. You know, obviously Zuckerberg is both CEO and chairman of the company. Is it just insane to think that there could be some risk to him in that position, or is he just so ingrained in the company that, it would be foolish for anyone to try to agitate to have him either, removed completely or at least give up one of those two titles, chairman and CEO?
So, I mean, the important thing is he would have to do it, right? He controls Facebook in addition to being, the CEO and the chairman through these super voting shares. So he would have to conclude or be forced by a court or something that this would be, better for the company. And I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And that's partly because of my sense of the psychology of Mark Zuckerberg, right? Like, this is his identity. You know, it's very hard to imagine him not being at the top of Facebook. I think it's probably very hard for him to imagine that. And I also think, the company has kind of found I don't know if you call it a scapegoat, but in terms of executive changes, right? Sheryl Sandberg is moving on, and she was some of the focus of some of the criticism around Facebook. So I think he has made some executive moves at the top in response to pressure. But I don't think one of those moves is going to be removing himself anytime soon.
So the point is and I think about as we talk about this story, and you're right, I think I feel like some of the conversations around it is like, oh, woe is, Meta. But I mean, this is a company still, even if numbers maybe or the growth numbers aren't as strong as they used to be. I mean, when it comes to things like advertising, I mean, this is still where folks go. And we've just got about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, it's unavoidable from an advertising perspective. And I think it's just worth keeping in mind that there's this political story playing out at the same time, which is that Facebook is under scrutiny and it's to its advantage to play up competition. So I think it's important to, just take it with a grain of salt every time they talk about fear of TikTok and so on.
Somebody managing the message, the narrative, Max? Is that what you're saying? I think he's gone. All right. Anyway, check out this story. You can find it on the Bloomberg and, of course, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek about Facebook and Mark Zuckerman. Of course, that was Zuckerberg. Excuse me. That, of course, was Max Jafkin, columnist at Bloomberg Businessweek, joining us on the phone from Queens, New York. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Businessweek. Carol Masser, Mike Regan, and this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, social media news sites, man, they lit up last night on the news that former President Donald Trump faces intensifying legal and political pressure after FBI agents searched his Florida home in a probe of whether he took classified documents from the White House when he left office. You've probably read the story. Well, that story, it is among the top five of today's most read stories on the Bloomberg. For more and understanding a bit about the legal aspect of this story, let's bring in Bloomberg News senior reporter Zoe Tillman. She is on the phone from Washington, D.C. Zoe, good to have you here with Mike Regan and myself. So what do we need to understand about the legal process and justification initially for that search at Mar-a-Lago?
Right. So, you know, the critical thing here is that to get a search warrant, to get a judge to sign off on a search warrant, you don't need to show that a particular person committed a crime. You know, this isn't the same as, you know, charges against the former president. What they have to show to a judge is that there is probable cause that they will find evidence of crimes at the location. You know, a big question for all of us is what exactly the search warrant says. Prosecutors would have to identify which federal crimes they think they would find evidence of, and that would give us a big clue into where the investigation is headed, who it's focused on, you know, what the potential charges might be, and what the potential penalties on the table might be. It's a very big unresolved unknown at this point. But you know, it's not as if the attorney general or the head of the FBI woke up one morning and said, let's go raid Trump's house. They had to bring something of substance to a judge who had to meet, you know, preset standards for signing off on that.
Zoe, I'd love to sort of tap into your expertise and experience covering court cases like this, because there are so many various investigations into former President Trump. Most of the reporting seems to indicate that this was focused squarely on the removal of documents from the White House and taken to Mar-a-Lago when they should have gone to the National Archives. But I wonder, you know, given all the other investigations, is it possible that evidence pertinent to those could be used from this search? Or does it all depend basically on what the warrant says? You know, what all can they take away from Mar-a-Lago that could be used in other investigations?
Right. So, you know, when they go in with a search warrant, they cannot just do a free-for-all look for any evidence of a crime. They usually have to specify, you know, we are looking for White House records with classified markings, or, you know, any evidence boxes marked classified, or these are from the White House. You know, but once they take those documents, if in the course of the search they see, I think that the phrase is sort of in plain view, but that can mean a lot of different things in practice, other evidence of crimes, that can be fair game for investigators to use, even if it's not related to the original purpose of seeking the warrant. So the classic example is, you know, FBI agents go into a house on a search warrant for, you know, looking for guns, and on the table they see drugs. You know, those drugs are fair game. It's a bit more complicated when you're talking about, you know, the contents of a document that's been seized pursuant to a search warrant related to some other issue of the substance or the circumstances of those documents. So it's possible, but it's not quite clear.
So you know, I've seen in some of the reporting on Bloomberg, different sources saying that this is unprecedented. But I am curious, is it accurate to say that this is unprecedented for a former president? I know people have talked also about the Clintons returning White House furniture after they had got home. I mean, is what's going on right now possibly just an oops on the part of the former president, Donald Trump, that he just took stuff home that he shouldn't have? Or I don't know. Like, how are we supposed to see this? And just got about 40 seconds.
Yeah, you know, I think my understanding is it's unprecedented for a search warrant to be executed at the home of a former president. That seems to be agreed upon. You know, normally prosecutors would treat a former president with kid gloves. They would try to get whatever they need through other means that are not, you know, a very dramatic execution of a search warrant, a, you know, quote unquote raid of a home. Mm. So the thinking here is that there is some urgency that prosecutors felt in taking this, you know, it's definitely more of an escalation than we've seen in the treatment of public officials coming from the Justice Department.
All right. And just quickly, 15 seconds. Is it related to the January 6th committee investigation, or we don't know?
We don't know.
Okay. That was quick. Yep. Go ahead. We will obviously be following your reporting, and I'm sure coming back to you. Zoe, thank you so much, really setting us straight in terms of the legal side of this to get a better understanding. Zoe Tillman, senior reporter. She covers legal issues and courts out of D.C. for Bloomberg News. She's joining us on the phone from the nation's capital.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Another one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg today, it has to do with college endowments posting their biggest losses since the financial crisis. So let's get the story from Bloomberg News higher education finance reporter Janet Lauren. She joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So good to have you here. So what's going on?
Well, given what was in the stock market for the year, the S&P was down 12%. Not a huge surprise.
I've seen my 401k. I know.
So I think what is surprising is the huge contrast from last year when you saw some endowments have returns of 50%. WashU in St. Louis had a return of 65%. So it's a big change. And, you know, the smaller endowments are definitely more heavily relying on U.S. equities. And, of course, bonds didn't do so well in the fiscal year, too. And usually the bigger endowments have a lot of help from private equity and other alternatives. Right. And they just didn't get that kind of insulation this year.
You know, Janet, full disclosure, I just wrote my first college tuition check for my oldest. So, you know, if I look a little shell-shocked, that's the reason. But, you know, reading this story from that perspective of a parent of a kid going into school, I can't help but worry, does a poor endowment year mean that tuition's going to go up even more next year, especially with this inflation? I mean, colleges are dealing with inflation as much as anyone else. But how do you think about tuition in sort of both of those variables, a high inflation and a poor year for endowments?
So good question. The good news is that spending is not determined by 1 year of endowment returns. It's typically an average of 3 to 5 years. No. So last year's amazing returns definitely helps even out the spending. Now, inflation is another story, because when colleges set their meal plans of, say, a 3% increase in February, they're actually having to spend a lot more. So you may see it next year in your overall cost for dining, or if your kid is still in the dorms, that may increase. Yeah, the inflation is a problem on campus, both in terms of the supply chain. You know, you may not get all the types of food you want in the cafeteria, plus a labor shortage.
So teach my kid to cook, I think, is the bottom line.
I am. My daughter's like reducing the meal plan as we speak. I love you include this in your story. Colleges typically need annual gains of at least 7% to keep pace with annual spending. And that plays to kind of some of the stuff I feel like you're talking. So as you said, though, they wait 3 years or something before they start to change some things?
It's an average of spending, depending on how they've done over 3 years, or some schools you do the rolling 5 year average. So 1 year is not going to have a huge impact on spending. Just like last year, when, you know, schools had very robust returns, they didn't spend it all.
Do we ever see an endowment, especially after a year that was so phenomenal last year, where they do park a lot of things in quote unquote a cash like investment and say, right? Because you could coast do they ever do that to kind of just play it a little bit safer?
Well, I guess it just really depends on the schools. And last year, you had an over allocation to private equity because the returns were so strong. We had a story about this a few months ago, that schools, you know, their allocation to private equity was in the 40% range.
Wow.
Because they just were, you know, they just did so well. One Michigan State was describing one fund had 1,000% return.
Wow. Well, amazing. Well, I wanted to ask you about that, the sort of the strategies of endowments. I mean, obviously you hear about sort of the stars, the David Swensons of the world. But you cover this space so closely. I'm curious, you know, the market nerd in me wants to know,
Do any of these endowments just do passive sort of 60-40 type of thing, or is everyone trying to be David Swensen?
Are you talking basically? Like a balanced fund?
Yes. Well, a lot of schools did try to be like David Swensen. And, you know, I think given the success of private equity and hedge funds, maybe not more recently, schools wanted to try to find other ways to make money. They saw Yale's endowment exploding. We did a big story several years ago on a school in Wisconsin that had been in index funds for 15 years, and their 10-year return beat the pants off of Harvard. So some schools, you know, they just don't have as much money. You know, if you're a tiny endowment with $50 million, $200 million, you can't get into those funds anyway. Right. So you're safer being in index funds, and you're ultimately paying less fees.
Yeah. Of course, this year you're getting clobbered like everyone else, I guess.
Right.
Both on the stock and bond end of it.
Right. It's just like, you know, it's just been the environment. So as a result of a year like this, do we ultimately then see endowments kind of retrenching and being even more cautious in terms of their plays? Or are they looking for some new alternative opportunities? I just wonder, like, what do they do in terms of adjusting?
They say they're long-term investors, so they're not really changing any strategies. They're still in private equity and hedge funds, and they may not be as much in commodities if they're, you know, if they're shedding fossil fuel type investments, which, you know, we're the best performer this year.
Is there a lot of that going on, the sort of ESG type of focus?
They're shedding. You know, if you're a $200 million endowment and you're in, you're in funds where you can sell things, it's very easy to say you have divested. But if you are a big endowment and you have lots of investments in private equity that, as you know, take 10, 12 years to unwind, you're not doing anything. You may be not putting new money in,
that's
but
true.
Things may be unwinding. That's what Harvard announced last year.
All right. Well, listen, as we said, it's among our most read stories on the Bloomberg in terms of what's going on with college endowments and their performance. Janet Loren, so great to have you in studio. Bloomberg, of course, news, higher education finance reporter Janet Loren. Check her out at Janet Loren on Twitter. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, Bloomberg City Lab has reported on the 15-minute city, basically giving every resident of a city the ability to meet their essential needs within a short walk or a bike ride. It's been talked about for Paris, a Utah suburb. And our next guest certainly gets that and plays into that. We welcome Mark Dixon, founder, executive director, and CEO of the workplace solutions company, IWG, International Workplace Group. Company has worked with Microsoft, Disney, BlackRock, Uber, so many household names. And we welcome him. He joins us on the phone from London. Mark, good to have you here with Mike Regan and myself. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good. Yeah, long day, but a good one.
I feel like every day is a long one. You guys, though, did report a financial update on your business for the first half and noted that as a company, you're looking forward with cautious optimism for the rest of 2022. Give us a little bit more color on your business specifically and what you mean by cautious optimism.
Well, look, there's a very, very strong change in the way companies are working. I think it's actually somewhat helped by the economic uncertainty that pervades in the world today. CFOs around the world are looking at ways they can control or cut costs. Hybrid working, that means, you know, allowing people to work in a more flexible way, close to where they live, is very popular. It saves about half the fixed cost. And, well, it's what people want. So it's quite an easy thing to introduce. And it'll also cut your carbon footprint by around about 70%. So, you know, there are a lot of sort of driving forces that are getting American and global companies to change the way they work. Things work well in the pandemic, but now there are new drivers, and that's really cost-cutting. So with that, demand is very strong for us in spite of a more difficult economy. And although we have to fight inflation like everyone else around the world, we've got very strong revenue growth, 23%, and that's converting into strong margin improvement and equally strong cash flow, which we're very pleased about. you know, this time when cash is absolutely king.
Yeah, Mark, I'm wondering what hybrid working looks like in practice. You know, I'm curious, sort of, what are the most common examples you're seeing? Is it, you know, Carol comes into the office Monday and Tuesday, I come in Wednesday and Thursday, and everyone's out on Friday? Or what are sort of the most common scenarios you're seeing for companies doing this?
It's something that's very much misunderstood. It's not about sort of coming into the office. It's about convenient working. So the elephant in the room here is commuting. It's not working from home. It's not working from a central office. It's avoiding commuting. So for workers around the world, commuting is very time-consuming. It's become a lot more expensive with the oil price increases. And, you know, it's inconvenient and it's unnecessary for many people. So what people are looking for is not necessarily working from home. That's okay occasionally. But it's not okay all the time because it can damage productivity. So it's about finding a place to work that's just down the road. It's finding a place to work that's convenient. And that's what individuals want. And for companies, as I said earlier, it's a lot cheaper. So hybrid work is about your workers out there working in more convenient, more localized locations. You have less fixed corporate office space, which saves you lots of money. And you bring people together once a fortnight, once a week, once a month. You bring them together to collaborate in a meaningful, well-organized, curated way.
Mark, just got about 25 seconds. We apologize. So are you seeing more companies opting to do that, saying, we don't want to have a lease, we're just going to get the space when we need it? And again, just about 20
Absolutely.
Seconds.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, just it's sort of think about it like Spotify is to music. We are to the real estate industry. Make it as a streaming product. Use it anywhere, any place you want. That's what companies want, and that's what individuals want, and it's growing fast.
Yeah, we always talk about the Uberization of the world or things on demand when we need it, and I feel like we are seeing that to some extent, as you said, Mark, in real estate when it comes to company. Mark Dixon, founder, CEO of IWG Global, joining us on the phone from London.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Come back soon.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, yes, indeed. We are counting down to the market close, just about 10 and a half minutes left. As we do so, a headline just crossing the Bloomberg, the U.S. Justice Department preparing to sue Google as soon as next month, according to people familiar with the matter, capping years of work to build a case that the Alphabet unit illegally dominates the digital advertising market. So just taking a quick check on Google shares, and they are right now just down about 0.5%. So they continue to trade off their lows of the session. All right, let's get to the markets. We've been bouncing around. We've got a big inflation print tomorrow. So great to have back with us Anne Mulledy, head of active equity at Allspring Global Investments. She joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. I'll get it out. There's just too much going on. You and I were just saying, remember when it used to be quiet in the summer? It's not. How does that, you know, the constant news flow, whether it's economic news, whether it's earnings news, whether it's Fed speak, or just questions about recession, no recession, how does that complicate kind of adjusting portfolios or figuring out where we go from here?
It's such a great question, Carol, and I think it's really about trying to tune things out sometimes, which is interesting because most people would go like, you have to know everything that's going on. The challenge is really tuning out the noise and carefully paying attention to the things that really only matter to the stocks that you're invested in or to your portfolios and your strategy. That's really what our investment teams are trying to do right now.
That's Carol's used to tuning me out, so she's
from
no
a large
stranger
family.
To
I
that
tune out a lot.
You got to tune
not
out.
Not just you, Mike.
But Ed, you know, one thing you have to sort of tune into is the earnings season, and I think it's been kind of a wild one. I mean, no surprise, it's been a wild few years, but it seems like some days you'll see a retailer come out and they're having all sorts of trouble and their stock tanks, and then the next day some other consumer company is like, no, everything's great. I mean, is it execution issues? Is it sort of idiosyncratic issues? Some companies are handling inflation and supply chain better, or is there something else at play, do you think?
You know, it's so interesting, Mike, because there's like a bifurcation that's really happening. And as we're looking at earnings, and I'm talking to our portfolio managers last week, and they were describing this too. Like, you almost have to bucket the companies that are talking about struggling with the consumer and then the ones that are saying, we're not seeing it yet.
Yeah.
And it's challenging because in the past, you would either see it, they'd all see it, or none of them are seeing it.
Is it a high-end versus low-end consumer
type
of story?
I think that's what it is. And the fortunate thing about me living in the Midwest is I'm talking to a lot of my friends' family who don't have a lot of disposable income. And, you know, one example, a friend of mine who uses a credit card only for groceries and gas said, and like my credit card bill, I looked at last year's, use it for the same thing, only those two things, over the last year. And so, you know, if you don't have a lot of disposable income, you're being impacted. And in the companies that were impacted, Walmart, Target, you know, the companies that are touching those, the companies that are saying we're not seeing it yet, Visa, you know, MasterCard, they're not, you know, they're touching more of the higher end consumer, the consumer that has more disposable income. We're seeing buckets of that. And then certainly companies that have higher input costs feeling more pressures as well. But real true bifurcation and not a lot of correlation between, you know, every company.
So, Anne, you know, we obsess about things like the inflation print tomorrow or a Fed meeting, like something like tomorrow's inflation print. How important is it to you and how you think about managing money right now?
Yeah. What's interesting about inflation is just kind of where we're at today and then the direction of where it's going. Tomorrow's print in of itself, not probably that meaningful. We want to know, gosh, have we seen the peak? Is the peak behind us? But again, that's only just a short-term metric,
right?
If we've seen the peak, are we going to, like, you know, test it again in the future? I mean, all of those questions still exist.
Because like, that's the thing. I do feel like there used to be times past where I think we could kind of figure out where we're going. And I don't know whether it's post-pandemic. I don't know whether it's just so much money that was pumped in and then now it's being sucked out. Like, I'm trying to understand that maybe this time is different. Forgive me for saying that, but I
think it is different this time. And I think the frustrating thing about being an investor in this market rather than a trader is that you're focused on the long term. And traders right now are focused on short term trading and focused on what's happening tomorrow and positioning for that. So if you look at the inverse correlation to like the biotech index or growth versus value, it's just trading on whatever the bond market's doing, right? And long-term investors are saying, no, I'm going to focus on quality here and companies and management teams that can manage through a clearly different, you know, regime change, paradigm shift, whatever you want to call it, for the future. We definitely have higher inflation. We definitely are going to see higher rates probably over the next decade than we've seen over the past decade. And stock selection is going to matter. The unfortunate thing is right now, the traders are winning and just swinging the markets based on but based on yield.
So when you talk about quality, and we hear this a lot, like it's kind of the time to be defensive and look for quality companies. How do you define quality? You know, is it dividend yields? Is it just strong balance sheet, all of the above?
I think free cash flow is going to matter more than anything, because the cost of capital is, you know, extremely high for some companies. And it's going to matter a lot more. I mean, when you had free capital, essentially, for so many years, it caused a lot of, you know, companies to get out of control, a lack of discipline, I would say. And you're going to have more discipline going forward. So I would say free cash flow, strong balance sheets, and then management teams. Management teams who have experienced different cycles before, that's going to matter a lot more.
No, no memes. Is it quality memes count?
I didn't hear Bed Bath & Beyond. AMC, I didn't hear that. Just got about 30 seconds. So where don't you want to be right now?
I think where you probably don't want to be is, again, I would focus on, you know, the lack of quality. I would stay away from, like, this rally we've seen in, you know, the high yield space, in the companies with kind of poor balance sheets, companies, you know, like if you just do a quick screen of companies that are going to need to raise capital in the next year, like, forget it.
Because it's going to be too expensive. Right. And it's going to be problematic. Right. Always wish we had more time. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
You.
Always good
it's
to talk
great
to
be
you.
Back.
Anne Maletti, she is head of active equity at Allspring Global Investments, joining us here in our Interactive Broker studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.